Hello, and welcome to episode 67 of Shelf Love, a podcast where we have thought-provoking, critical discussions about literature's most polarizing genre, romance novels. I'm your host, Andrea Martucci, and my guest today is Dr. Maria de Blasi. Maria is a writer and an educator, and is a full-time faculty member at Central New Mexico Community College in Albuquerque, New Mexico, as well as a part-time faculty member in the University of New Mexico's Honors College. Maria joined me in episode 41 to talk about pleasure activism, courtship novels, and the kiss quotient. She also joined me very recently in episode 66, where we both learned so much from Dr. Margarita Guillory about African diaspora conjuring practices in popular culture. That episode was a prelude to this discussion, and we reference some of the things we learned in this episode. In this episode, we talk about three books that share a common theme. All three are contemporary romance novels with female main characters who are Black and either identify as witches or practice everyday magic, and they are not paranormal romances. The three books we discuss are Zenny by Rebecca Weatherspoon, A Taste of Her Own Medicine by Tasha L. Harrison, and Take a Hint, Danny Brown by Talia Hibbert. We are going to talk about some of the common themes, how these books differ, and also how you can practice everyday magic. It's not quite as woo-woo as you think it might be. I also have to fess up that in this episode, Maria and I say that Sonia, the main character from A Taste of Her Own Medicine, identifies as a witch, and upon closer reading, and also upon asking the author, Tasha L. Harrison, turns out that's incorrect. This is especially ironic given the whole extended conversation with Dr. Margarita Guillory about how some practices are described by outsiders as witchcraft, but would not be described as such by practitioners. I don't think it invalidates the things that we talk about from the text, but FYI, Sonia does not identify as a witch, and I apologize for the misidentification in this episode.
My name is Dr. Maria de Blasi. I am a professor at Central New Mexico Community College and the University of New Mexico. This year at the University of New Mexico's Honors College, I'm teaching a course on the legacy of witchcraft in popular culture. So in that class, we look at the history of witchcraft, both in terms of specifically the history of witchcraft in America, and a lot of people are familiar with Salem witch trials and that sort of stuff, but we also look at how that played out in the American Southwest, where I'm from, in terms of Spanish colonization and the Catholic Church, and how that demonized or villainized other forms of spiritual practices, particularly through Latinx and indigenous lenses or cultures. And then we also look at really fun stuff like movies that shape the way we think of witchcraft, TV shows, books, popular culture, which influences people for better or for worse. And when I'm not teaching, I'm a writer and I'm a practicing bruja. So as I said in a previous podcast, I identify as mestiza, which is claiming mixed race identity, specifically Latinx, indigenous, and European ancestry. So I come from a really big mix. I'm a product of colonization, basically, in New Mexico, which is a very intense history to carry in your bloodline. So part of my brujeria practice is letting go of the violence of Spanish colonization, reclaiming the indigenous roots, the Latinx roots, and a lot of those spiritual practices. Curanderismo, which is like a folk healing, curandera is like a folk healer, but also contains elements of like spirituality and magic, for lack of a better term. So reclaiming those ancestral ties, what we have knowledge of, because there's also been a tremendous amount of whitewashing and assimilation and erasure. So as mestiza, you reclaim what you can and also what is safe for you to do, because it can be dangerous to dig too deep into those histories of trauma. It can trigger things. We take what we can and then we build our spiritual practices through that. I also just want to say before we dive into this, and I say this in my own writing, I don't speak for all brujas or mestizaje, because we are a large and eclectic sponge. We are not a monolith. So when I do speak about things, it's more through my own lens. And I tend to focus more on what I call everyday magic, which is natural spirituality, things that we think of in our everyday life that we don't think of as magical that really are. Like brewing a cup of tea is really making your own medicinal potion. So there's a little bit of pop culture in that. There's a little bit of my own background with Curanderisma and different ties, but that's a little bit about me. So I'm really excited to be talking to you about witchcraft and romance novels and popular culture.
Yes. And we just got off our fantastic conversation with Dr. Margarita Guillory, who spoke to us about conjuring practices with people of African descent who live in America. And even there's just so much to unpack in your introduction, because I think that there's elements of pleasure activism that you're talking about, which is a major topic that you spoke about last time you were on Shelf Love, and that sense of acknowledging the situation of how you came to be oppressed and sort of like not denying that, but then trying to also then move forward and experience pleasure and joy and reclaim, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. So part of it is definitely about, yeah, pleasure activism, and I call it pleasure magic practice. You know, it's like a nice way to think about it. But when you do have that history of colonization in your blood, when you are another body, it can be really difficult to access pleasure because your sexuality, your right to joy, it's demonized or suppressed. Mainstream religion can suppress it. People have all sorts of ideals about the, you know, hypersexualized Latina or the whatever. And so part of brujeria is reclaiming that and your own autonomy and saying, I have a profound capacity for joy, for pleasure, for abundance. And that is separate from other people's perceptions of what that should look like for me. Mm-hmm. And of course, part of that practice, that pleasure magic practice, is figuring out what that even means or what joy or pleasure feels like. Because if you haven't had access to it, or you're realizing that there's a lot of white norm, social norms that you've internalized, you're undoing that work and relearning your relationship to pleasure. So it's an exploration. It's also brujeria, and this is something I talk about with my students in my class, it's a form of social justice. So you're making yourself visible, you're making yourself loud and saying, you deserve to take up space. Minority bodies, other bodies deserve to take up space, and not necessarily so that the white gaze can take us in. So we're not there for the white gaze.
I think this ties in so nicely to where we got to at the end of the conversation with Margarita about reclaiming witchcraft as a way for Black millennials to reclaim something that allows them to be.
Yes.
And so much of that is being who you are, being an individual, not suppressing any part of yourself, but also not necessarily expecting that identity to look like any particular identity that you see. Maybe you're similar, but you're also yourself and it's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love how Margarita said it's about room to be dot, dot, dot. So there's that suggestion of exploration. And it's definitely about that. It's about taking joy in the process and the process of discovering your autonomy and sense of self. And particularly if you're from that mixed race background, there can be a tremendous amount of pressure to identify with one of those cultures over the other. The kind of Spanish colonizer side wants to kind of forget about anything that's indigenous or Latinx, or there's other people who are like, well, if you know you have those indigenous ties and you can connect, like, you have to go back. You have to find, by any means possible, to reclaim those things, or this is what it means to be Latinx, so you should be expressing your culture in these ways. And in reality, it's a very complex issue, and everyone identifies to their cultures differently. Everyone has a different relationship to them and expresses them differently. So part of that, finding the space to be, as Margarita said, is saying, how do I explore my cultures? And how do I do that in a way that is separate from either the white gaze or those various cultures telling me how I should feel about my cultural identity?
Right. And it's a way that's not dogmatic or prescriptive. And you just mentioned the idea of the hypersexualized Latina, or the hypersexualized other, we could say, or as I recently learned about when Xu Ming Tio was on the podcast talking about Orientalism as basically this idea of the other, people who are gendered feminine as the other are often given this like sensual, hypersexual identity. I also recently read a chapter in Jayashree Kamble's book where she unpacked whiteness associated with Protestantism and Protestant work ethic, but whiteness as pure, almost asexual, like, you know, the Virgin Mother has a child but is chaste. So then there's this dichotomy between like white purity, not sensual, and then the other being hypersensual. And yeah. We're here to talk about romance novels, believe it or not.
It's a whole part of the mix.
We're going to get there. So I think probably our question that we want to explore is, how are some recent modern romance novels dealing with identities such as the identity of being a witch, particularly for Black heroines in romances? And we have three examples of characters who claim this identity and explore it in various ways. And the three romance novels are Zenny by Rebecca Weatherspoon, A Taste of Her Own Medicine by Tasha L. Harrison, and Take a Hint, Danny Brown by Talia Hibbert. So before we speak more about each of these novels' connection to the things that we talked about with Margarita and a connection to our own thoughts and feelings about all this stuff, let's just give people a little bit of an overview of these three books, although we're not really going to deep dive into any of them. So do you want to start with Take a Hint, Danny Brown? Do you want to give a brief overview, particularly the characters? What tradition are they tapping into? What do we need to know about how witchcraft is explored?
Absolutely. So I'm going to gloss over a lot of the major plot points and just tell the witchy part of the stories. And I will say, before I give the Take a Hint, Danny Brown overview, is one of the things I like about all three of these books, and I think why we chose to cover them, is that they look at modern witches as like actual live practitioners and not in a paranormal setting. So when I teach my Legacy of Pop Culture class, I introduce my students to a variety of spiritual practices that could fall under the frame of witchcraft, because I don't think people realize that it's an actual thing, and it's got very many different iterations, particularly depending on your cultural context. And each of the women in this story has such a different orientation to what that term means to her, which I think is also important, and we'll unpack it later. But first, Take a Hint, Danny Brown. So Danny Brown, she's an academic and a witch.
I feel like we should mention that we focused our conversation earlier on American conjuring traditions, so we should acknowledge off the bat that Take a Hint, Danny Brown takes place in England. Majorly different location, but...
And that's why I stopped, because I was like, I have like the Caribbean and this and that. And I was like, nope, it takes place in England. But she is following the Obeah tradition. And the preface starts with her basically calling on the goddess of Oshun, who is like the goddess of love, and calling for a fuck buddy. Like, I really need a fuck buddy to make my life complete. And Danny has a lot of commitment issues. She's been hurt in the past. And she meets up with Zaf, who she has a crush on. He's the security guard where she works at the university. He has his own hang-ups, but he loves reading romance novels. And they get together after a random incident couples them off as internet sweethearts. They go viral, and they do the whole fake relationship thing / real-life fuck buddies, and romance ensues. But what I think is interesting about Danny is she does have that Obeah tradition in her family. She knows it's there, but she hasn't been formally trained. So part of the story is her trying to figure out what that means and what that looks like for her.
Yes, and I think that this book has the most direct conjuring. Like, you see it on page. It's very much embodied on the page, I think.
I think it's also what someone might more traditionally perceive as like a magical practice or a spiritual practice, because they're in front of the altar and they're giving up offerings and all of that. Mm-hmm.
So now our second book is A Taste of Her Own Medicine by Tasha L. Harrison. Would you also like to give a little overview of this one?
Yes, and I will just say, if you haven't read this book, it is like total good medicine. It's just a really beautiful book. So it is about Sonia. She's 40, she's newly divorced, and you kind of get the sense that her marriage is a little bit toxic, not super healthy. She's trying to find herself, And she decides that she wants to open up her own potions and lotions shop, as she calls it, at first. And she comes from a line of women who practice the Gula tradition in the American South. And her mother is a really powerful, I think you could say, conjure woman, maybe, who embodies that. And her mother has an organic herbal garden where she brews her own medicines and lotions to help people. And her daughter Sonia wants to carry on that tradition, but more in a city context and with her own. This is what I thought was really beautiful, not just pulling on the traditions from her mother and grandmother, but putting her own magic and her own spin into it. To do that, though, she takes a entrepreneur class with a young gentleman named Atlas. He's younger than her. He's 31. And they start up a romance pretty quickly. And this book is incredibly beautiful because she ends up calling her shop Good Medicine. And this book is all about the power of healthy relationships. The healing, sexual healing is real. Romantic relationships are healing. And that herbs and medicine and the energy you imbue into the products you use, the things you take into your body, is incredibly powerful.
Yes. And so, full disclosure, Tasha L. Harrison is on my editorial advisory board, and I speak with her often. And one thing that she told me specifically, I was checking in with her on trying to find other recommendations of romances that could fit this theme that we were talking about. And I was like, what does authentic Black witchcraft look like? And she is actually the person who explained to me part of the secrecy around some of these practices, where she told me that her background, I believe maybe distantly in her family's past, practice some of this stuff, but she's not learning from anyone in particular, like in her family line. It wasn't anything that was really passed down very explicitly to her. So she's also in that process of rediscovering this, but that there are things that she is an outsider to and can't quite get access to, and also things that she does know that she chooses not to share in her fiction because of that sort of holding it sacred to the people who practice it and not for consumption by others.
Yeah. Absolutely. And there are some things that are private and sacred and that are just for you or within the culture. Or I like what you said about how she said she's an outsider to even certain parts of that practice. So I feel the same way with a lot of the indigenous connections in my ancestry, because indigenous culture, you know, and their various tribes, they're so heavily appropriated. It's terrible how much cultural appropriation happens. I feel very careful about saying I'm an outsider to these things. I do not have the same kind of access. And so I want to be respectful of that boundary, because we do live in an era of, I think, pushing past those boundaries. And sometimes it's meaning, sometimes it's in an effort to reclaim. But I think those boundaries are important sometimes to have a healthy respect of certain experiences aren't your lived in experiences. And so it's okay to not try and take anything back.
And so our third book is Zenny by Rebecca Weatherspoon. And if you'd like to once again take it.
Sure. Yeah. So Zenny is really interesting because I should mention the both Zenny and Danny Brown, they're both bi, as is Mason, who is the hero in Zenny. And I bring that up because part of the conversation, cultural conversation surrounding witchcraft, is that it is, there's a whole queer subtext to witchcraft. I'll just put it that way. So it's not just reclaiming sexuality. Part of it can be reclaiming non-heterosexualities and celebrating. So Zenny is an unexpected heiress. She inherits her aunt's fortunes and house, but it's on the condition that she marry Mason, who is a lovable Scottish cinnamon roll. They have to be married for 30 days, and then they can divorce. So they agree to do this marriage of inconvenience because it is helpful to both of them. And Zenny tells him right away, before we get married, you need to know I'm a witch. Now, for her, it's beautiful because she says, I don't share this side of myself with a lot of people. And it's not because she's afraid or she feels like she has to hide it. But you get the sense that it's very much like she decides who deserves to know about this. And it's private otherwise. And I think that's powerful because that is definitely a part of the witchcraft tradition, regardless of whatever your cultural orientation is. Although hers is hysterical because it is definitely drawing on pop culture. So the way she talks about being a witch is through the movie Practical Magic, which is also based off of a book, but the focus is on the movie Practical Magic. And so she takes that iconic line from that movie, all women are witches. And so for her, being a witch, is it's a given. It's just a natural part of who we are. And she says some of us are more aware of it and can tune into that energy, and some of us aren't as aware of it. And then, of course, her big witchy problem is that she has practical magicked herself, as she says, which is that she conjured up this idea of such an impossible perfect person for a romantic relationship that they can't possibly exist. And so in her mind, that means she will never find love. But of course, this being a romance novel, we know that stuff's about to change and already is changing with her and Mason.
And I just finished this one. I read it explicitly for this podcast, although I had been wanting to read it for a really long time. So I was really happy, as I usually am, that I had a good reason to move it up the list. I thought that there was a really beautiful line through Zenny about both Mason and Zenny really allowing themselves to be their authentic selves. And part of that is sexual. Part of that is being emotionally vulnerable and allowing somebody else to see you warts and all. That's a witch joke. So lame. But really, to be authentic, I think that they're both extremely careful with each other, where they're like, are they joking? I am not going to laugh until I can read their mood. And I think this connects really well. I see kind of like a through line from that aspect of Zenny to A Taste of Her Own Medicine, Sonya reclaiming sort of her individuality and her authentic desires. Like, she has suppressed a lot of this as being a wife and mother. And she is separating from her husband, from whom she has not expected much sexually in terms of identity and relationship and romance.
And I believe there's a statement in that book where she has never had a partner-induced orgasm.
Yeah, I believe that's true. And is that also true of Zenny, and or it's just very unlikely? She did not often in one previous partner.
Yeah, like, it wasn't amazing sex. For Zenny, she's like, I never felt comfortable enough to really talk about what I wanted or what I'd like to experiment with. And with Sonya, I think her husband was her only partner, and they were together for, like, I don't know, 20 years or something, since high school.
Yeah.
And her friend mentions, they have the conversation about the moment when Sonya actually had, like, this earth-shattering orgasm, but it's not with her husband. So it's, I think it's with a toy. And then when she finally gets with Atlas, she's like, oh my God, is this what sex can be like? So you get the sense that she's been very sexually unfulfilled, but never actually realized that she was, because she didn't know that sex could be more, because she'd only had that one partner.
And I think that Sonya was wrapped up in a lot of playing a role of who she thought she needed to be. What does being a mother look like? What does being a wife look like? What is my role in the economic situation of my family? And part of her journey is dreaming bigger. Like, when she's building her business, she at first is sort of like, I don't know, maybe I'll have some tables at like craft fairs or whatever. And then starts to really like envision a bigger future for herself and expect more out of her romantic partners, her sexual partners, her business ventures.
Absolutely. And so that sounds like a really simple concept, but I do just want to point out that's a really good example of everyday magic or conjuring and thinking about giving yourself permission to dream bigger. So if we're even thinking about it through the lens of pleasure activism or pleasure magic, it's, hey, I am allowed more. What if I dreamed about wanting more? Because what happens is we start internalizing the limitations that get placed on us. So it takes a little bit, and you see this in Sonia's work. It takes her time to work through that. Even her sisters, she wants to go into business with her sister. She feels safer to her, and her sisters, no, you can do this on your own. Like, you are fully capable. So her family members see that she has this potential, but she has to grow into it by taking risks.
And not to put too fine a point on the sexual aspect of it, but I feel like there is this story of trying to fit in to this idea of heteronormativity, of prioritizing male pleasure and or your partner's pleasure. In the case of Zenny, where she has been afraid of really tapping into and then vocalizing what she really wants. And so prioritizing others' needs above your own.
Right. And Mason, too, in that. So he's bi, but his father is really homophobic. He shames him. And so that's something Mason always feels like he has to keep a secret. Mm-hmm. He tells Zenny before they're getting married, she just says, "You need to know, I'm bi, I'm a witch." And that's so liberating for him. So he's like, "Yay, I'm bi too." And so not only do they have the opportunity to be really open with each other and vulnerable, as you said earlier, but I think the important thing is that they know they're in a safe space. Even though they're still trying to fill each other out, they're realizing because they've been put in such a strange situation by her aunt, who clearly loves them both, there's a little bit more of a built-in trust and the sense that they have nothing to lose by being very open and honest with each other. And they've both said, even though I'm sexually experienced, I've never really felt safe enough, comfortable enough to really explore with someone. And right. So that's one of the first moments where they bond together, where they're like, and not just sexually, but also like, I've never been able to have this transparent a conversation with someone. This is liberating.
Mm-hmm. There's this really interesting part towards the end of Zenny where Mason has made himself smaller by falling back on family expectations of who he should be. And he has throughout the story and sort of his backstory after this situation with his father really been forced to also make his life small. Like, he has these dreams and he has let his father shut those dreams down and shut him down from exploring other paths and really committing to any of those paths. And before they reunite, he has this conversation with his mother about witchcraft. And apparently he gets quite a lecture. They're Scottish. He gets quite a lecture on like Celtic magic and like, this is, they're Catholic and this is bad, 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 bad. But yeah. Also, this conversation with his mother about it somehow helps him clarify his own list of what he wants to conjure as a perfect partner.
Yeah, absolutely. He's like, I'm sort of done with a lot of the really conservative negative stuff. Like, Zenny's a witch. She accepts me for who I am. I can talk to her. I really don't want to be around the other vibes that tell me who I should be or how I should behave or put such heavy restrictions on other forms of self-expression, including witchcraft. And I think, you know, it's so interesting because in the same way that like Zenny and Mason have this sexual awakening, emotional awakening, you see the same thing happening with Sonia in A Taste of Her Own Medicine. And what I think is so beautiful about Sonia is that she's an older woman and in many ways experiencing a sexual awakening for the first time. Like,
I mean, she's basically a crone, as say in the witch lore.
Yeah, little old lady, right? At the ripe old age of 40. But she's realizing, wow, I don't think I've ever had a sexual awakening, at least not like this. And it's different for her because she's had children. Atlas is younger. But so I think it's really powerful that in both Zenny and A Taste of Her Own Medicine, it really is like an example of sex magic or sexual healing. It's, wow, just to feel this overwhelming pleasure with someone I trust is amazing. Now, take a hint, Danny Brown is on the opposite end of the spectrum. Danny is very comfortable having very good sex with whatever consenting adult she's attracted to. Her journey is feeling safe to open up emotionally. It's not addressed quite as strongly in this book, but I think because she's a woman of color in academia, that gets addressed when she meets her idol, and her idol gives her advice on how to survive in this climate. And the idol tells her, you know, find joy wherever you can, and basically just gives her permission to be a human being. Zaf, reading romance novels, kind of exposes her to this world where emotions, feelings are valued over needing to be super logical and have it together all the time. And it's interesting that she's a witch who is also struggling with that, which is not uncommon, I think.
Right. And I think that for Danny, there is that concern that a partner will be demanding and will try to make her stray from her goals. So it's a sense of protection. Like, before I get too emotionally involved with somebody who then is going to pressure me or make me feel guilty about how committed I am to my work, I'm going to just say, this isn't for me. I can't have it all.
And then she internalizes the idea from an ex that, like, she can't do relationships or that she's no good at it because she doesn't know how to do the girly things. But you realize, like, she thinks of it as, I don't know how to do the girlfriend stuff. But by the end of the story, you realize, actually, you really do. You were just with a jerk who cheated on you.
Yeah.
That's not your fault, but his. So it's a lot of her coming to terms with the fact that there's nothing wrong with the way she is. She was just with someone who was expecting her to be someone else.
Yeah, it does seem like that is the through line of all three of these stories, right?
Absolutely.
Pressures, self-imposed, cultural, from intimate relationships. The message that these people are getting is that there is something wrong with them. They have to fit a mold, and they are breaking out of that mold and reclaiming and asserting their power and individuality too. Like, I'm going to do this my way.
Absolutely. And that's like witchcraft 101, whatever your tradition is. It's, I'm going to do this my way. That's the ultimate spell. Mm-hmm. Or however you want to identify it. That's the ultimate thing where you say, I have been told to think and feel and express myself in certain ways or to perform in certain ways. Brujeria for me, for example, is about taking that power back and saying, but what do I want? What feels authentic and healthy to me? And it's a very simple thing to think about and something that all these books talk about. But I think what all these books show is that it's also really hard to go on that journey. Mm-hmm. Because it does require having to let go of so much and having to unlearn so much and take that risk, which can feel really frightening.
And I'm thinking specifically of the conjuring spell that Dani practices at the beginning of the book, Take a Hint, Dani Brown. And I asked this question with Margarita, basically, what is the difference between magic and a prayer? And I want to just like unpack for a second. So I grew up in a family that practiced Catholicism, although I am atheist, and I probably identified as an atheist from the age of 16. And then when I left my parents' home, was finally able to like stop practicing Catholicism. So anyways, that's my religious background and what I'm most familiar with. And also I exist in a society that is completely Christian centric. I'm thinking about how religion, specifically like Christianity, might be layered into a romance novel, where you might have a character pray for a particular outcome, and that would be seen particularly in a Christian romance, like an inspirational romance, but even like in romances not explicitly marketed as Christian, like praying for something would not be out of the ordinary. Like you might see that, right?
Yeah. I mean, it can be as simple as transparent as, yeah, like an inspirational romance. And, you know, the hand of God does whatever he's going to do to someone like, oh God, I pray so-and-so's okay. The idea of prayer is so mainstream. It's interesting because as you were talking about the prayer with inspirational romance, I think the difference there is that God is all. So the power is with God versus the individual, even though they're the ones praying. Which is, I think, how a lot of like more of the religious stuff is set up, whereas witchcraft is more empowerment of the self. And so Margarita was talking about the power comes from like spiritual powers, maybe some higher being, but also is within the self. And that's something that you don't necessarily see in some of the like religious romances. The power is always outside and gifted upon you.
You earn that power by being a good person, not right. by doing anything in particular towards that goal.
Exactly. And by being a good person usually means that you're like white, hetero, cisgender, able-bodied, and neurotypical. You yes. know, so it's like a lot of elitism. Whereas witchcraft is taking the power back and saying, no, the power is within me, and I'm not beholden to anyone to express that. Yeah. There are larger energies out there in the universe, but they are within me as well as outside of me.
So I've heard the term manifesting yes. used before. And so I'm curious if you could explain a little bit about what that looks like, because it strikes me that manifesting is you identify this desired outcome, and then manifesting is the practical steps you're taking to create the environment under which that can occur.
Yeah. So there's a lot of different ways to look at manifesting. And so I'll talk about it, how it's maybe thought of in more, I was going to say mainstream witchcraft culture, which sounds like the
oxymoron.
Yeah, an oxymoron. But I think the way people traditionally perceive it within witchcraft, and then I'll give you my own spin on it. But manifesting, it would be like what we see in Take a Hint, Dani Brown, where she's like, I want to fuck Letty. I'm going to ask the goddess Oshun for it. I'm going to do my ritual, and then I'm going to keep my eyes out for it. So I am saying, this is what I want. I'm focusing my energy on it. On Instagram, manifesting is, I want my dream job, so I'm going to light my candles and do my spell work, and then I'm really going to go after it and figure out what I need to do to get it. So it's not just asking the universe or whatever gods and goddesses you want to call to, but then you have to do the work. So one thing I like to point out is sometimes I think what gets lost when people talk about witchcraft is like, it's this idea where you have this really cool spell book and you light your candles or you pray to this deity. And then people are like, why isn't it working? It's because you also have to do the hard work. So in a lot of my writing, I talk about how magic is a hard, gritty thing. So I tell my students the story of, I always wanted to be a published author. And I manifested that. I put that energy out into the world. But I also read constantly. I wrote constantly. Like, I put in the hours. And so the universe, whatever, it needs to know that you're doing the work as well. And that's the manifesting. That's the real conjuring or everyday magic. Or so I call it everyday conjuring or everyday magic. That's the real work. If the spells or the lighting of the candles helps you focus that energy, that's great. But actually being at the desk, typing, reading the books, informing yourself, that's what produces the results. That's kind of how I read my own expression of brujería. It's not as glamorous as a lot of the Instagram expressions of witchcraft, but it's not that one is wrong over the other. It's just mm-hmm. a different way of looking at the same thing.
And some of that, like the ephemera, seems yeah. to be about creating the environment under which you yeah. feel you have that power.
Exactly. And if, yeah, exactly. If like you need those tools to get in that mindset, that's completely great. But then you have to ask yourself too, should I be manifesting this? Is this something I should be pushing for? And take a hint, Danny Brown. I mean, she basically asked for a fuck buddy. Mm-hmm. Universe, or, you know, Oshun, the goddess of love, she's like, that's not what you really need. So what I'm going to give you is true love in the guise of a fuck buddy, or however you want to really read her relationship to Zaf that she ends up in. She's like, that's not what you really need, but I'm going to give you what you need in the guise of what you think you want. So sometimes you have to be careful what you're asking for. So like, I've definitely been in situations where I've said, I want this job or this thing, but the manifesting feels like such an uphill battle. This is taking way more energy than there's hard work and then there's I'm drained. And so you have to decide, is this the path I should be going down? And
right.
every time I've let go of those things, I always find out something weird. Like some sort of synchronous thing happens and it's, oh, this is why this situation wasn't right for me. I didn't know it at the time, but you could totally interpret it as the universe saying, you don't really want this. You think you want it, but let's go over here instead. Make the energy really hard for you, so you will leave it alone.
That was one thing that Margarita was talking about, sort of the intent behind what you're trying to conjure. So I thought that was super meaningful, right? And this is actually related to practical magic, right?
Yeah, like, absolutely.
If you're trying to get rid of an abusive partner who law enforcement can't help you and there is no other power to call upon and you want this person gone and out of your life, is it bad to want
yeah, right?
them to... I mean, I forget how in the movie or the book, it's based on a book, I forget exactly what they request, but he is dead.
Yeah, the book is very different from the movie. The movie is like very much a sparkly romantic comedy, and I haven't made it all the way through the book yet, but it's definitely a heavier book. But in the movie, yeah, it's billed as a romantic comedy, but they kill off this guy. They put too much, I think, nightshade in his alcohol.
Like and you he, do.
So yeah, exactly, as one does. And so it's a little bit of an accident, but then they're like, we got to cover up the evidence, so they, you know, bury him in their backyard, as you do. But what's always interesting to me watching the movie again is that it's billed as a romantic comedy. We think of it in lighthearted terms, but basically they kill a man and get away with it. And no one's sorry about it. No one's sorry. They're like, yeah, he needs to go. He's an abusive guy and he's a super creep. Goodbye. So yeah, that's a moment where it's like, he's a terrible man. He was going to kill him. They just did what they needed to do to protect themselves and the world at large.
That feels like justice to me.
Yeah, yeah. And it's specifically because you know he's leading up to basically saying he's going to kill them both. And you yeah. know that's going to happen the second they pull over, he does whatever he wants. So they're protecting themselves and their family. They're good people. He did a whole bunch of other terrible crimes to other women. So you're like, he should go.
Right.
However, you know, you see the movie The Craft, which was done about 2 years before, I think, or around the same time. And it's the same thing. You know, have this group of young teenage girls. They're doing witchcraft, but what they do is they start enacting revenge on the people in the school. So the creepy dude predator, the racist person, and so they enact all their fantasies, and that's a really good example of it's all fun and games, and then they start realizing that their actions have consequences, and they're wondering, like, should I have enacted this? And it's less about the people they enact revenge on and more about wondering who am I becoming when I'm playing with these forces that I don't even really understand.
And in that case in particular, the intent to start was wanting something better for themselves, but then actively, maliciously wanting to harm. Not to harm to save yourself, actively bring harm to these people, which I think is very much in line with, I think Margarita was talking about how that used to be how witchcraft was, like, the original practitioners would not call it witchcraft because witchcraft was harmful practices and they were not practicing that.
Exactly. And self-defense is something a lot different than saying, this person pisses me off, I'm going to make them suffer. And it's definitely justifiable. Like, you take pleasure in their magical practice in that movie when they do get revenge because you're like, yeah, those people suck. But then it becomes a slippery slope. I mean, they kill someone off. Nancy, the witch who goes crazy, kind of has like a non-consensual scene with the guy she ends up killing off. And so he's the predator and he becomes a person preyed upon. And that's the moment where you're like, whoa, you crossed the line. You're becoming the thing that you were fighting against. And so I think it looks at that slippery slope of, the malicious side of witchcraft.
And I really like what you were talking about earlier, even just coming back to the word practice, where I believe that the same way we want our doctors to practice medicine so that they are on this journey of always improving, always practicing their craft, using it. They're using the muscle. It's staying strong, getting stronger, etc. What you were talking about with sort of setting the intention and then doing the work, putting in the effort to make whatever it is that you want manifest. In the white Christian tradition, there's two things. There is A, that some people are more deserving of good things to happen to them. And if something good happens, it must be because you're a good person and you deserved it. And if something bad, it must be because you've sinned or you're not worthy of this in some way. So there's a sort of a determinism there, like you're either worthy or not. But then there's this like weird Protestant work ethic thing, right? Just keep working and work, 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 and just be happy with that.
Their work ethic is like, you're not manifesting. That's just what you do. Like,
so. Right. It's waking up and pushing a rock up a hill, but with no meaning, with no personal satisfaction.
Yeah.
You don't want to roll the rock up the hill.
Yeah, exactly. And so when I taught American literature, early American literature a couple years ago through the Norton, and I hate those textbooks, but basically it was 8 weeks of American Puritanism. And it's like, I'm going to rot in hell unless God blesses me. And I don't know how that's going to happen because he just kind of chooses whatever, but I got to work a lot too so that I'm not a sinner. And it was just like 8 weeks of poems and little stories about that. And it was like so depressing. And then we got to Edgar Allan Poe and there was this like uptick in interest in the class, like, ooh, this is interesting. But one of the things we talked about was like, it's so oppressive, that ideology, but it is such a strong foundation today in our country, regardless of your cultural orientation or religious beliefs. So much of the indigenous culture has been erased. The foundation is that Puritan core.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it affects everything even today.
Yeah. And then there's like ties to capitalism. Who does this benefit? Who does the meek inherit the earth benefit? The people who have the earth while they're alive. I obviously have issues with Christianity.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, too, like you see this now with a lot of the anti-maskers, if we're talking about the pandemic, they just pray away the problem. And that's a form of manifestation. They just want to give it up to God. There's this house in my neighborhood that has a sign like, Lord, if you decide that you want to free us of this plague, please do so. And it's like a little visual prayer, but they're not thinking like, here's the work we can do to stop that by like wearing masks and practicing social distancing. So it was really funny when the whole pandemic unfolded, you had that side of things. And then all my pagan and witchy friends who you think would be like super out there were like, wear your mask.
Yeah.
Social distance. Here's all these ways to keep your immune system healthy so you're less susceptible. And it's so in many ways they represented a more rational perspective.
And is it any coincidence that the people who do not feel concerned about this are not people who are vulnerable because they are in communities where a large percentage of people are essential workers or are vulnerable in other ways because of systemic issues that have harmed them and their communities?
Yeah, so the people who are less likely to believe it are the people who are also less directly impacted.
And so, most protected by systemic advantage.
Yeah, and I still know people who think that it's a hoax. I've done a lot of unfriending of people over this. But they think it's a hoax because they don't know anyone who's directly impacted or has been directly affected. So it's a very different situation.
I was thinking about, on a very like personal level, about like practice and like manifesting and doing the work towards the thing you want. I definitely grew up with, through a variety of cultural messages, I don't know how much of this is religion or just American culture or whatever, this idea that you're imbued with what you are imbued with, you have some sort of natural talent. Actually, this has a little bit of overlap with being in a gifted and talented program and told. This was a conversation I had with Nicole Falls. Being told that you're special then creates this paralyzing fear that you're not going to live up to this thing. And the way I phrased it is like, well, I'm so fucking special. How come I can't do anything? And I think that one personal development that I think helped me grow a lot as a person was realizing that instead of sitting around and like festering about the things that are not happening, decide what I want and move towards it. And day after day, practice, do the thing. And,
exactly.
And it's also that idea of how do you become the thing you want to be? Not just by wishing really hard for it. You just do the thing every day and then you become the thing.
Yeah. And it's, if you think about the, like, I'm gifted or I'm special or whatever, that's parents literally trying to manifest that abundance for their children or that, that sense of being able to do anything. What happens, and I say this as when I was in graduate school, part of my bread and butter was tutoring students like that. And I think part of what gets left out of that equation is no one's really showing them the day in, day out work and the messiness of that, that like, yeah, you can be really smart. But part of being smart is making a ton of mistakes and putting in the work. And what they miss is the blood, sweat, and tears of that kind of magical practice. Or I want to be healthier. Okay. You can't just wish it. You got to like
do it every day and
exercise or whatever better health looks like for you. Drinking 8 glasses of water, whatever it is. It's like you got to follow through with that. And I think that's one of the things that becomes less fun for people. I think they like the kind of beautiful Instagram pictures of witchcraft, and there's nothing wrong with that, but it can sell this illusion that it's as simple as wishing on a crystal ball or wearing crystals, and then you magically get this. It's like, nope, you also have to do the day in, day out. And it's funny because one of the things my students have learned in the class is like, what they think of, I gave them some resources that showed actual witches and how they define their practice and what that meant to them. And from a variety of different backgrounds, contexts, even witchy practices from pagan to Wiccan to brujeria, all these different things. And a lot of it was like, I take time to commune with nature. I go for a walk every day. I have too many mason jars. I just honor my own power. And a lot of it was very mundane stuff that people didn't really perceive to be magical. Their pop culture perceptions of magic are very ritualistic, very over the top, lots of really fancy tools. And a lot of practitioners are like, yeah, maybe I might do some of that. But I'm also just like really focused on putting good energy into the stew I'm making because that is healing. So it's a lot more of a grounded practice than I think people realize.
I don't even know like how we wrap up this conversation. There's obviously some commonalities between these romances that portray contemporary Black witches in romance. There are these obvious ties to like romantic relationships with other people, relationships to yourself, sex. But I think the biggest thing is that sense of identity.
Right.
And I wish that there was a cleaner answer about like, why now? Like, why Black witches now in romance? I mean, I think that there's been a good number of European representations of witches, but like more in that paranormal sense. Like I know Nora Roberts has had a ton of vaguely paranormal, like I think a little bit of like, is it magic or isn't it? We're not sure. But it's like vaguely paranormal. There's obviously lots of very paranormal in the European tradition of witchcraft way. Why now for Black witches who are practicing more in the vein of what Margarita Guillory is talking about in the populations she's studying? Maybe in part that's the answer, right? Is there's like increasing visibility of this subculture and then it makes its way into romance.
Absolutely. Because I think, like, my students, they talk about, wow, there's such a resurgence of witchcraft now. And it's one of those things where it's always there. It's, you know, like Margarita was talking about, these things were always there historically. It was always going on. But it might just feel more visible to people who aren't part of those communities because maybe it's getting more play in popular culture or the media. But, like, if you are part of those communities and you know where to look, this is an ongoing conversation. So it's like nothing new under the sun. But I do think Margarita talked about it. It was the coolest, what was it, the phrase, digital religion or those digital covens. I think there's so much more accessibility and it's easier for people to find information. So it is more prevalent. Mm-hmm. So it's easier for people to find that information. I will also say, if we're looking for a way to tie these all together, I want to briefly fangirl about A Taste of Her Own Medicine and then show you my connection. But when I read A Taste of Her Own Medicine, I identified with it so much because it's obviously very different spiritual traditions, but she's talking about, there's this great scene where Sonia imbues this like body butter or oil with like sensuous feelings, and it's particularly meant not necessarily to attract a lover, but to make you feel sensuous in your own body. So it's like reclaiming your own sensuality separate from needing to be desirable to someone else. And the way she described it and the oils and the scents and then the success scent that she shared with the class, I was like, oh my gosh, that reminds me of the curandera practice so much that I practice, where it's like you're really intentional about the energy you're putting into the oils and soaps and body butters you make. You're harvesting herbs from reliable sources or what you grow from your own backyard. So it's a very earthy practice, and it's about being intentional about what you're putting in and on your body and why you're doing it.
And like what you're taking out of the earth or environment.
Exactly. And also recognizing that sometimes you could put like negative stuff in there. You're like, why does this soup taste like crap? It's because I was in a really bad mood when I made it. So let's get rid of it. So really being conscious of your energy, your mindset, what you're putting into the earth, what you're giving back. So it's a very natural, grounded way of looking at things. So I think that's a story where people might not have directly realized that was part of a magical practice, but I think a lot of people have had those experiences where they felt just really wonderful after putting on some amazing smelling lotion or smelling fresh herbs or going out for a walk in nature and just feeling revitalized by that. But what I will say about these three books, to tie it all together after my fangirling moment, is that I think what they all have in common, and I talk to my students about all three of these books, is I think what they really do is they normalize witchcraft. So to go back to what I said earlier, they normalize and they celebrate it. So they aren't villainized for being witches. It's not something they have to keep hidden, which is like a huge theme in paranormal romance. They're just like, this is just another part of who I am.
And they're not bestowed any particular magical power. They claim it themselves.
Exactly. And they're also not there to save the world, which I think is great.
We don't all have to save the world.
Exactly. They're just like, this is just part of who I am, and I'm living my life. So I think, you know, if we go back to what Zenny says vis-a-vis practical magic, all women are witches, or you identify that way, then you are that. I think it's about taking back your power, right? And if the romance genre at its very best is about women or more feminized genders taking back that power, being front and center, the protagonist of their own story, claiming their autonomy, claiming their sex positivity. There's quite a bit that overlaps between romance novels and witchcraft. And that's what I tell my students. You'd think they wouldn't necessarily have a lot in common, but they do. Mm-hmm. Because they're grappling with those same issues.
I've been thinking a lot about the women and marginalized identities framing.
That's why I stumbled over it. I was like, how do I say this? I'm just going to keep going.
But, yeah. I know. Yeah. Would you agree with marginalized genders?
Marginalized genders. Yeah, that sounds really great. Because the other part of it is that, yeah, it's a complex issue. And we're talking about, in these three books, especially like intersectional identities. So it's important that it's not like white women witches, which I tell my students, like a lot of it can be a placeholder for white feminism and all the problems of that.
Yeah.
So it's important to show like POC witches.
Yeah, the great part about what romance as a genre I think is trying to do is it is focusing on the lenses of those who are traditionally not allowed to have their story told and be in a position of power. And so increasingly I've been thinking about it as like stories by and for people with marginalized identities.
Oh yeah, that's perfect. And specifically I would say that's romance at its best.
Yes.
Like most like fulfilling or manifesting its deepest potentials, right? Yeah, by, for, and about people with marginalized identities. That's great. Yeah. I'm going to start using that.
Yeah, it definitely took me a while to get there. And I think what I forget is it's not that I don't ever read romances now that are problematic because they are not challenging the worldview and power. But I tend to actually read mostly things that are doing that and challenging the right things, I think. But I forget sometimes, like, how much of the genre really is not doing that.
Even like The Legacy of Witchcraft, we're looking at the original Charmed this week with my students, and we look at some shows that are very much about white feminism. So I am empowering myself as a feminist, which really means, like, white, hetero, cis woman. And it's often at the expense of other marginalized bodies. Or you get the rhetoric in Charmed. One of the sisters literally says in one of the intro, like, first couple episodes, it felt really good helping people. And it was right after they helped, I think it was, like, an Asian character from, like, an Asian magical background. And you're like, ooh, white savior. And, yeah, and then it becomes, yeah, like, a who's who of cultural practices that they don't really understand. And they're helping those people. And then they're appropriating, too. And it's supposed to take place in San Francisco, but it's not really that diverse in terms of, like, sexuality or, you know, POC representation. There's a whole genre of witch media that's very much, like, as radical and empowering as it's supposed to be, it's actually quite conservative.
Yeah.
Hashtag also Romancelandia.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. But yes, I think we can talk about the promise of the genre and then talk about individual failures and or successes.
Yeah.
Or some things are a mix of both.
Yeah, yeah. And I loved how you rephrased that it's at its best a genre by, for, and about marginalized identities. Because historically, we think of it as, like, the women's genre. Mm-hmm. And I think now we're in a really interesting area where we can say it's not just a woman's genre anymore. In fact, it shouldn't be. That's part of the whole toxic patriarchy when it's like, women are only this. So yeah, that's pretty cool.
Maria, thank you so much for coming back for, like, round 2 and 3 all in one go. Where can people find you? And how can they keep in touch with you and what you are up to?
Thank you so much for having me again. This was super fun. I loved our conversation with Margarita too. Hugely enlightening. There's so much I'm looking forward to looking into now. If you want to learn more about everyday magic, so I will say I practice brujería, but a lot of the stuff I write about on my blog is not brujería exclusive because I'm careful about cultural appropriation issues. Like, I make that claim because I don't want people to take stuff from my blog and assume that they're practicing brujería and then deal with maybe issues of cultural appropriation on their part, depending on their cultural orientation, which is a roundabout way of saying you can find me on my blog. It's just mariadeblasi.com. And if you're interested in exploring your own kind of witchy side, I do have a lot of tips and explorations there, recipes and potions and lotions that are not necessarily culturally specific, but they're a way for people to explore everyday magic in their own lives.
Thank you for listening to episode 67, and thanks to Dr. Maria de Blasi for joining me. Thank you again to Dr. Margarita Guillory from Boston University for sharing her thought-provoking research and expertise, which informed this episode. A transcript and show notes for this episode can be found on shelflovepodcast.com. If you are looking for spooky romance recommendations with witches, ghosts, etc., check out my list of curated recs on shelflovepodcast.com. The next episode of Shelf Love might be coming to you in 2 weeks. We're going to have to see how this week goes. For those of you listening to this episode in the future, I am recording this outro on October 29th, 2020, and next Tuesday is a presidential election, and I'm a little on edge right now. I'm not really sure if I'm going to feel like putting an episode out there. We're going to have to see. But never fear, I have some exciting recordings happening, and you'll just have to be surprised when they come out. Thank you so much for joining me today. If you have any thoughts on the show, I would love for you to reach out to me. You can send an email to Andrea@shelflovepodcast.com. This episode is produced by me, Andrea Martucci, and a huge thanks, as always, to Shelf Love's editorial advisory board members, Katrina Jackson and Tasha L. Harrison. In addition to advising me, they write books. Black Lives Matter. Stay safe, stay mad, and keep reading romance. So let me wrap this up. Maria, thank you for joining. I always do this like super cheesy. Hold on, let me try to be like less cheesy. Maria, thank you for joining me today. Sorry, no, I can't. Get out of your head, Andrea.
Don't have to go, I can set you free. Are you gonna make-